Good evening and welcome to Public Radio Presents on WRVO. I'm Bill Drake. Tonight we bring you highlights from the 2018 Great New York State Fair Storytelling Competition. The two-day event was new to the fair this year, and WRVO was pleased to be invited to be a part of it. The first night of the event, Friday, August 31st, was billed as the Great New York State Story Slam. 10 individuals told stories live from the stage, 5 minutes or less, with 3 winners chosen by a panel of judges. The second night, on Saturday, September 1st, featured 2 master storytellers, Linda Lowen and Sean Kirst, telling longer tales. Tonight we'll bring you highlights from the competition, including stories from the 3 Story Slam winners and those from Linda and Sean. We'll start with one of the winners from Friday night's Story Slam. Here's Isaiah Buchanan on WRVO.
Okay, so this piece is called Heading North. So imagine this 5-6-year-old just growing up in New York City, the bubbling metroplex, with just life and diversity all around you, and just understanding that there is so much to life without knowing that there is so much to New York. So for me, growing up, upstate was anything that was past 125th Street, which, if you know New York City, that's just Harlem. So my first adventure to Washington Heights was like, wow, oh my goodness, Mom, are we in Connecticut? Is this what we do? And Mom's like, no, there's still more to New York. I'm like, so what's next? She goes, there's Westchester. I'm like, oh, okay, so Westchester, the best Chester. You go up there, you take the Metro North, and what do you see? You see trees, you see grass, you see large houses, you see rabbits. I'm like, Mom, are we in Vermont? She's like, no, you're still in New York. I'm like, where does New York end? She's like, how about Albany? I'm like, okay, Mom, like, let's do this. We can do Albany. That's not too far. So my friend's dad in middle school decides he wants me to understand where he's from. His hometown is Kingston. So we're in the car for what seems like forever on 90, and we get to Kingston, and all of a sudden you see deer. I've never seen a deer in my life. And he's like, you have to make sure when you drive, you have to watch out for them. But the good thing is that they taste really good. You eat Bambi? Like, what world are we in? So we're barbecuing, it's the summertime, I'm reading Harry Potter, just enjoying life in upstate New York. And I'm like, I don't want to eat Bambi, so just get me a hamburger. So my friend's dad comes over. And I should have known something was up because he was way too chummy with this. But he's like, hey, I have a burger for you. And I bite into this thing and it's like dripping. I'm like, this is so delicious. The most glorious burger I've ever had in my life. I'm like, something tastes different about this burger. This is a hamburger, right? It's like, no, you just ate Bambi. And at this point, I'm so traumatized because I'm thinking back to the time that I yelled at my uncle, who's a hunter, and had a buck on his wall, and I told him that he was a family killer. I'm like, what is going on? But it was just so good. So I learned Bambi tastes delicious as well as made an awesome movie for children. So that was a learning lesson. But then my journey upstate continued. All of a sudden, I find myself going to college in upstate New York. I went to school in Schenectady, which I never heard of until I looked at the Common App and was like, there's a great school here. So I checked it out, and I'm like, wow, it's like a little oasis. You get to see the foliage change. And I'm with the upstate students called a leafer because I was so amazed by the different colors of everything. And I'm like, wow, there's more to life? Like, what can I do next? Fast forward a few years, I find myself living on a farm in Esperance, New York, raising chickens, painting fences, and driving around on a four-wheeler. So this adventure from the number 2 train to making my way over to Albany and now to Syracuse to go to upstate has been like one huge whirlwind of like, where does upstate end? And I finally know that's Plattsburgh, right? Okay, that's what I was told because I've made it out to Buffalo. And I know that the Bills play out there, so I'm all about the sports. I'm like, New York has so much to love. And then there's wine country around the Finger Lakes. So again, there's more stuff to do here in New York. And I'm like, this place is so much bigger than the 5 boroughs. And it's so much bigger than Central Park. And it's so much bigger than BAM or anything else that you'll find in the city. there's life, there's culture, there's diversity. There's a lot of things to do in upstate New York that you can't do in the city. I can actually take a breath of fresh air and feel good about it at the end of the day. Plus, the streets don't smell like someone's dirty diaper. That only happens during the summer in the city. The winters in the city are pretty nice, but they have nothing on you guys up here. I do not know how you handle the winters up here. I've learned to enjoy the summers, and then during the winter, bundle up in so many layers that I look like the Marshmallow Man. So I just want to say thank you very much, because life in New York is diverse just like the rest of us.
Isaiah Buchanan, one of three winners of the 2018 Great New York State Story Slam, on stage at the New York State Fair on August 31st, 2018. It was the first of two evenings of live storytelling at the inaugural Great New York State Fair Storytelling Competition. We'll hear from the other Story Slam winners later in the program. The second night of the competition featured stories from two master storytellers. Here's the first from Linda Lowen. This is called Will Work for Air Conditioning.
What I'm going to tell you is a true story, as all stories are, and it is called Will Work for Air Conditioning. 2 o'clock in the morning, middle of the summer, my husband wakes up, and I hear him making his way through every single room in the house, upstairs, downstairs. He's doing the same thing again and again and again. He's throwing open windows, positioning fans, turning them on, and blowing cold air into our house. We do not have air conditioning by choice. We're a very green family. But what we do have is a super insulated house. So the idea is, if we cool it down overnight, and the coolest hours are between 2 and 6 a.m., the house will stay cool all day, in theory. Kind of works, maybe a little, maybe not so much. This matters to me because I'm a freelance writer, so I work from home. My husband he's an engineer, so he gets to escape to an office where he enjoys the benefits of air conditioning. Now, I am aware that not having air conditioning is good for the environment, but it's not so good for our marriage, because by the end of the day, as the temperatures creep up, I get hot, sweaty, nasty, and I'm raving. And by the end of the summer, I am non-functional. I don't do the dishes, I don't cook, I don't vacuum, I don't do laundry. It's all I can do not to kill somebody. So, as you might figure out, I dread June, July, and August. How will I get through another summer? So 3 years ago, I thought to myself, I am going to try a crazy experiment. And in early May, I took a job for air conditioning. So I took a job as a copywriter for a home furnishings company. And they had a corporate office, huge boxy building, very few windows. And I interviewed in the digital marketing department, and they only had two windows. So I interview and I tour, and oh my. Every woman in that building is wearing a sweater. And one cubicle sticks out in my mind because it's beautifully decorated. I mean, there's framed art, there's accessories. It's like something out of Instagram, hashtag dream office space. And the woman in this cubicle, she shares it with two guys. She's actually wearing a down jacket to work. That's how cold it is. I think to myself, I want this job, so I take it. First day at work, my boss named Kara, she seems cool. She's got her long hair swept up in a messy bun, dangly earrings. Hey, Linda, guess what? We've got a place for you right by the window. You're not gonna freeze like the rest of us. And she shoves me into a cubicle, four-person cubicle, and she says, guys, this is Linda. Deb will show you around. Have fun. And she leaves, and she does not talk to me for the next 6 weeks. My cubicle mates don't talk to me either, even though I walk in and say, hi, I'm Linda, nice to meet you. It's like I'm in kindergarten, and they are all in time out, and they're standing in their corners. Well, they're sitting in their corners, and they're silent. So I think, okay, I guess I'll get to work. And I turn to my own corner, and I see a desk, I see a chair, and there's nothing else. And by this time, I'm like so frustrated, so I just scream at the air, "Where's my computer?" And a whiskey and cigarette voice answers back, "IT's working on it. You get it tomorrow." And I turn around, and it's Deb. And she has been there longer than any other employee at the company, and it shows in her face. But she is a nice person, she says. "We all come in early. We leave early, so I don't have time to show you around today. Come in tomorrow, 7, 6 if you can. I'll show you the ropes." Okay. So I come in at 6:15. Building's locked. I knock on the window. And she lets me in to the building, and she lets me in to the secrets of life at the ranch. First, she gestures toward the ceiling.
"The owners work upstairs. Gotta watch out for them. 3 rules. Rule number 1, don't microwave fish or popcorn. They smell it, they come down, you're fired. Rule number 2, don't use staplers or sticky notes. We don't have them here, don't bring them in from home. You send a memo around, it goes upstairs, they see it, they come down, you're fired. Rule number 3, keep your desk neat. Don't leave anything around. They come down after hours and check. They come down, they see it, you won't be fired, but it'll be thrown in the dumpster."
And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I'm feeling a little sensitive and shaky about this, but then I realize it's still 6:30 in the morning. I haven't had my morning cup of coffee. I'm sure life will be better once I get some caffeine. So I say, "Hey, Bev, where's the coffee machine? Because I didn't notice it when I toured, and I didn't see it in the break room." And she says,
"Coffee? They don't give us coffee. You bring it from home."
And the look of horror that must have crossed my face, because basically I consume coffee the way most people breathe. It just keeps me alive. So I look horrified, and she says to me,
"Don't worry. I've got to show you something to make you feel better."
And she takes me to a plain wooden door with a keypad in it. She punches 4 numbers in, and she goes through, and as she opens the door, she says,
"You'll be spending a lot of time in here because you're writing about the furniture.
And on the other side of that door is paradise. It's ice cold. It's like walking into a meat locker, and it's a giant room bigger than a football field. And it has one of everything that this company sells. So we're talking dining room tables and chairs, bedroom dresser side tables, and what makes my eyes light up, couches, love seats, recliners." And she sees the expression that I have, and she says,
"Yeah, we all sneak in here now and then. It's okay, we don't tell. Don't spend more than 10 or 15 minutes, because Carol will come and find you."
So, okay, we head back to the cubicle. It's closer to 7 now. Cubicle mates come in. I'm still trying to be friendly. "Hey, nice to see you. Good morning." Nothing. And then Deb makes the strangest noise. And I look at her, and she's straight up in her chair, but she's asleep. And I think to myself, I have made the worst mistake of my life. I just want to run down the hall screaming, "I quit, I quit, I quit." But I can't. Because of Dan. I didn't talk about Dan because it's complicated, my relationship with Dan. He got me the job. He recommended me. I am twice Dan's age. I've known him since he was 5. He's Chinese. I'm Japanese. I know you were all wondering. And his parents are Caucasian. So whenever people see me and Dan together, they assume that we are mother and son. But once we open up our mouths, they know we're not, because we've known each other so many years. We have a bunch of inside jokes. We are rude. We are funny. We laugh hysterically when we're with each other. And most people, when encountering us, feel very insecure because they think we're talking about them. I won't say whether that's true. But anyway, that's my relationship with Dan. So the first 2 days, I'm so busy, I don't have time to go in the break room. But on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, Dan and I meet up. We go into our usual routine, and people start staring at us, and they start talking. So, end of the first week, I go home. It's Friday evening. The house is hot and sticky, because I have air conditioning now. And my husband says, so honey, how was your first week? And I whine, it's not as air conditioned as I hoped. My cubicle is warm. The people in there are colder than the air temperature. I don't really like it, but I guess I'm gonna stick it out. So by the end of the first month, I do more than stick it out. I love the job. No, I don't love the job. I'm lying. I love the air conditioning. And I can't imagine how I lived without it before, because it's just a great place to escape to during the day. And you know what? So what that my cubicle mates don't talk to me? Because I take a Robin Williams approach to greeting them in the morning. Good morning, cubicle mates! And when they go away at night, hey, great, have a great evening. See you in the morning. Nothing. But I finally crack through. The guy next to me, he grunts. Girl on the other side, she smiles. And Deb, well, I don't take that personally, because that's what she does. And I have made other friends, which is a good thing, because in the beginning of that week, first month behind us, Dan texts me and he says, it has been suggested in the interests of my career that I not hang out with you at work. And I say, what? But I know why. It's Kara. She has a huge crush on him. Everybody in the office knows. And he texts me and he says, don't worry, we can still go out for beers. Which I look forward to, because honestly, the job is called copywriter, but it's really data entry. I'm typing in numbers, furniture dimensions, color, texture, size, shape, whatever. And if I do get to write descriptions, they are so boring. Somebody writes copy about bar stools. Well, I was that person. 97 descriptions of bar stools, 168 descriptions, separate descriptions of wall art. You know when you go to a hotel room and there's something hanging over your bed? I wrote the description about that. So we are looking at gondolas floating on the canals of Venice. We're looking at flower markets on Parisian cobblestone streets, red bikes leaning up against white picket fences. And it's so mind-numbing that I start to spend a lot of time in that warehouse where it's cool and I can lean back in a recliner and, you know, take it easy. And until Dan got his cease and desist, he would come and join me. So we treated it like our adult tree fort, you know, our own little place we could sneak off. And I spend as much time there as I can. And I'm there till I'm shivering. I'm there till my lips are blue. Because back at home, we have given up all pretense of trying to keep that house cool. I'm not there anymore. So now it has turned into a blast oven. My husband no longer does the 2 to 6 a.m. Chinese fire drill of opening windows, setting up fans. And I leave the house at 6 in the morning, and I don't come back until after 7 at night. It's not because I love the job. It's because I love air conditioning. And this thing with Dan is really grating on me. So I text him Friday afternoon, and I say, hey, are you allowed to go out for drinks, or do I have to ask your office mommy for permission? He says, yeah. And I meet him out, and I buy him enough drinks to get him drunk enough to admit, yes, it is Kara who has said this. And I'm frustrated, and I say, you know, I've known you since you were in first grade. She's known you, what, 8 months? You're going to let her come between us? And he comes to his senses. A few beers doesn't hurt. And he says, yeah, you're right. I'm not going to let her tell me what to do. Now, I know this is very high school, and I shouldn't behave this way. And I did make a concession to him. I agreed, okay, we will not meet in the break room for lunch. Instead, we will go out to a very sad picnic table by the parking lot. And it's hot and it's miserable, but at least we have our privacy. Until the moment that Kara comes out to her car during lunch one day, and she sees us, and the look on her face says everything, because she trusted Dan, she hired him, she hired me on his recommendation, and she now sees me as a threat. And I realize I have to watch my back. Well, you know how they say you really can't judge whether or not you like a job until you give it 4 months? 4 months is September. Temperatures have cooled down. And I actually like working at the ranch. The people that I work with are really nice. The guy next to me, he's a comic book nerd, and he's a single dad raising 3 teenage kids. The girl on the other side, she's shy, and she doesn't talk very much because she's from Puerto Rico, and her native language is not English, so she's a little self-conscious about her accent. And the reason why Deb is sleeping is because nights and weekends she works as a bartender. So she and the rest of them are decent people doing the best that they can. And Kara seems to have accepted my relationship with Dan, and she even springs for our whole department to have one of these team building days off-site. She even gets a catered lunch, and afterwards we all gather around in a circle and talk about what we like, and I'm the last one, and I get mushy too, hey guys, I know I'm the most recent hire and I know I'm twice the age of most of you in this room, but you guys have made me feel like family. I love you, thank you. And I imagine myself there at the ranch throughout the seasons. Snow falling in the parking lot, rain splattering against the window in the spring, and another summer in air-conditioned comfort in my cubicle. Well, the next morning, Kara calls me into her office and says, here's a box, fill it up, you're moving. You're going over to the main marketing department. And I'm stunned, but I realize that where I'm moving is the department that oversees everything. So they do the radio commercials, the TV commercials, the print ads. So it's kind of a promotion, and I'm not going to be working for her anymore. And get this, the place that I'm moving to is that really nice, fancy Instagram, you know, perfect office cubicle, and the woman that I am pushing out is the one who's wearing the down coat. So it's a win. Because I'm joining two copywriters, and they've been really nice guys since the beginning, very friendly. So I'm moving to the cold cubicle. I'm moving to the fancy, pretty cubicle. My coworkers are friendly people, and my relationship with Dan is out in the open. Nobody seems to have a problem. So I feel like I've hit the jackpot. But I'm wrong, because the two copywriters are incredibly lazy. And they'd start dumping their work on me. They shy away from projects. They're playing fantasy sports most of the day. And I'm really frustrated. And so I go to my new boss, and I say to her, hey, this is what the guys are doing. And she said, why do you think I brought you into this department? Because it needs fixing. And if you can't fix it, I'll find someone who can. Well, Dan's not happy either because he didn't get transferred, but he's got a new boss, and they're fighting all the time. So he pranks me as his form of stress relief, and he texts me and he says, hey, got any more extra boxes from your move? Because I have just been fired. And after the third one, I text him back and I say, will you stop it? You are the golden boy. I am the stepsister. You are never going to get fired. And I am the stepsister, because in my old department, I was pretty much left alone to do my work, and I did it, and it was manageable. But in my new department, this guy, Evan, supervises me, and he's not a good writer, and he's destroying my work, and it's going to go in print, and people are going to say, wow, Linda's a really lousy writer. How did she end up here? And I feel like I'm going to get fired anyway. I give it a month, hoping it'll get better. It doesn't. And finally, I go into my new boss and I hand in my resignation. And she's livid, because I've only been there a month. And she says, well, I guess you don't have what it takes to make it here. No, I don't. And guess what? It's now November, and I don't need air conditioning. They've turned on the heat at the ranch. The heat's on at my home. And I am ready to call it quits. 6 months, that's all I could do. But we're in fall. So on the day that I pack up all my belongings and take it out to my car, it is a balmy 46 degrees. Yes, I have survived summer. Monday rolls around, and I have a twinge. Should I have quit that job? But then the phone rings, and it's Dan, and he's not texting me. He's calling me. So I pick up, and I say, what's up? You're calling to gloat because you're employed, and I'm not? And he sounds strangely subdued, and he says, I got fired Friday after you left. They actually escorted me out of the building. And I said, come on, stop it already. And he said, no. He said, I was so embarrassed. I didn't want to call you or tell you all weekend. He said, but you know what? I finally look at it this way. You're unemployed. I'm unemployed. Let's celebrate. We're done with life at the ranch. And I am, unfortunately for him, I'm secretly thrilled because he got me into it. And he got me out of it. So I say to him, yeah, let's go celebrate. You want to go have lunch? You want to go have beers? And he laughs, and he says, let's do both. We have all the time in the world. Thank you.
Linda Lowen with her story, Will Work for Air Conditioning. That's from the Great New York State Fair Storytelling Competition on Saturday, September 1st, 2018. I'm Bill Drake, and you're listening to highlights from this year's inaugural storytelling competition on WRVO Public Media. Just ahead, another winner from the Story Slam competition as Public Radio Presents continues on WRVO. Welcome back. Tonight on Public Radio Presents, we're hearing highlights from the 2018 Great New York State Fair Storytelling Competition. Still to come, our story from Sean Kirst. But first, we'll hear from the two other winners of the first night's Story Slam. This first story is from Karen Walters, followed by Mike Baker on WRVO.
Hi, my name is Karen, and I'm an occupational therapist. That is a health profession that helps people engage as fully as possible in the things that occupy their everyday lives. And when you're part of somebody's everyday life, you're part of their story. Storytelling and story listening are important to me. And my story today is called My Untimely Arrival in Central New York. So I grew up in southeastern Michigan, and if you know anybody from Michigan, we all use our hand for a map. So I grew up here at the base of the thumb. And when I graduated from Eastern Michigan University, just a little bit further inland, I decided that I was ready to see other things and live other places, hopefully warmer places. So I joined a traveling therapy company, and I got some nice warm assignments in Oklahoma and in Tennessee, and I moved around down south for a couple of years. And I was getting burnout on long-term care nursing home assignments. So I called my recruiter and said, I'll go somewhere different. What do I have to do to get a break from this type of setting? And she said, well, we just got this assignment in Syracuse, New York. They're an affiliate of United Cerebral Palsy. They provide services for people with developmental disabilities, including dayhabs and group homes and aquatic therapy and assistive technology. And I said, oh, this would be perfect. This is the reason I became an OT, was to work with this population. And so I moved from Chattanooga, Tennessee to Syracuse, New York in February. And I arrived on a Saturday and went to work at my new job on Monday. And it snowed 18 inches during the day. And at the end of the day, I realized I didn't have a snow brush. I'd been living down south for 2 years, and I drove a big full-size conversion van with the high top, and I was buried in the snow. And I had to ask my brand new coworkers to help me out so that I could get home. And they did, it was great, and I got myself settled for the winter, snow brush, snow tires, snow shovel, all of that. Made it through winter into the spring. Spring in Central New York is glorious. And by then, they had offered me a full-time position, and I decided that I liked it here. I loved the job. I love the people. Someone else mentioned how friendly it is here. It was so friendly here. I was ready to call this my home. So I bought a house in Chittenango, and I moved there in August. My first house. I've never owned a house before. And that was 1998. The first weekend in September was the Labor Day storm. And so now I'm in my first time house, no power, going to work with no power. After 4 days of getting ready for work with no power, I decide I can't do this. I need to go buy a generator. And I had checked around. There were still two places that had them in stock. So I went over to the Agway building off of Manlius Center Road in the Fremont area. And I'm ready, and they're out of power. They're selling things by flashlight. And they said, oh, yeah, we've got generators, but they're electric start. Well, how does that work? And they said, oh, you need a battery, kind of like a motorcycle battery, but we're out of those. Okay, that's not a good option. I drove up the road to the Home Depot, paid a little more than I had planned to. This is my first big purchase now after I just signed up to buy a house. And I have help loading it into my big van. I'm driving, and I pull into my driveway, and the power came back on. So I have since used my generator. I am still in the same house in Chittenango. I still love Central New York. I keep trying to convince my family to move here. I love working with people with developmental disabilities. I love the scenery around here, the fact that you can travel, go for a road trip, and just see so many different things. And I'm tolerating the weather in Central New York, just like I tolerated back in southeastern Michigan. Thank you.
I was born in Rome, New York, which is in New York, as you know. I lived in a trailer park when I was in Rome, and then when we were six, my parents decided to move to Camden, New York. It's about 30 miles away. The good thing about living in a trailer park is that moving is pretty easy. A truck just came and picked up our house and moved it. And when you're 6 years old, it's like a weird experience to wake up and look out your window and see one thing, and then later that day go to bed and look out your window and see something entirely different. But it was an interesting experience for me coming from Rome, which, you know, as a six-year-old, I thought was a big city, and going to Camden, which is a, if you're unfamiliar, it's a town that's very small. When I lived there, there was one stoplight. When I was about 16, we got our second stoplight. And I kid you not, we had a parade to celebrate the second stoplight. So it took me a little while to sort of get my feet wet in this new town. I didn't have a whole lot of friends throughout elementary school. And then finally in fifth grade, I sort of felt like I was getting in with the cool kids. And towards the end of fifth grade, one of the last days of school, the coolest kid in the school, his name was Johnny Walker, seriously, he handed me an invitation to his birthday party that summer. And I was ecstatic because the coolest kid invited me to his birthday. My mom was a teacher in that district, and so when I ran home and told her that I was going to Johnny Walker's birthday that summer, she told me, there's no way that you're going, because she had heard all the stories about Johnny. And the reason that I thought he was cool was the reason that teachers hated him. He did stuff like write swear words on the chalkboard when the teacher wasn't around, and he got into like a lot of fights, which is weird for an elementary schooler. But I thought he was cool, and I was excited to go. My mom said, no way, he's bad for you, and also, we definitely can't afford to be sending you to birthday parties and having to buy birthday presents. Like I said, we grew up in a trailer park. We didn't have a whole lot of money. We had this concept that I think is sort of unique to our family. I've never heard of anybody else that had it. We had this thing called New Ketchup Day, which is, being poor, we ate a lot of foods that came in boxes and freezers that you put ketchup on, like chicken nuggets and fish sticks and stuff. Yes, we put ketchup on fish sticks. So we went through a lot of ketchup. My parents were like desperate to save money. So my dad would, when the ketchup bottle was half empty, he would fill it with water and shake it up. And then we'd have ketchup, this watery sort of gross stuff. But you can really only get away with that once. So eventually he'd have to go out and buy a brand new bottle of ketchup. And that was New Ketchup Day. And that's when everybody rushed to put as much ketchup as possible and enjoy the full ketchup flavor. So that was like sort of our financial situation. My mom didn't want to have to buy a present, so she didn't want me to go. She thought the kid was bad news. Eventually, I beg all summer long, and finally the day of the party, I'm like, I'm just begging her to let me go. And she says, fine, you can go, but we can't afford a present, and we don't have time to go to the store anyway, but I'll drop you off at his house for the party. Like, even at 10 years old, I knew that I couldn't go to this birthday party empty-handed. And I also knew, like, I didn't want to give him, like, something used of mine. So I sort of, like, scoured our house for something that was, like, brand new and unopened that I could give him. And, like, time was running out. And I settled on a ream of copy paper that we had. It was brand new, so that was good enough for me. I wrapped it up in, like, old, like, Christmas wrapping paper that we had. And my mom takes me to the party. So we get to Johnny's house, and I'd never seen his house before, and we get there. And my first thought is, oh, my God, he's rich. Because his house had two stories, and at that age, that's how I judge whether you're rich or not, was whether you had stairs in your house. because we didn't. And so we get to his party, and like looking back on it now, like Johnny was not rich. Like his front lawn was like littered with like car parts and used cars and like toilets and stuff. But like at the party, that was awesome because we were running around like pretending the cars were tanks and like pretending to take like poops in the toilets and stuff. And we're having like this great time, and I sort of like all my worries wash over me. And then finally, his mom calls us in for cake and presents, and we get inside, and there's this table with all the presents on it. And then it hits me, I got this kid paper. Even worse, I bought a rich kid paper. This is terrible. And so he's opening all the presents, and he's getting all this like cool stuff, like super soakers and video games and like stuff that a 10-year-old would enjoy. And he's opening them all up. He's just walking up to the table, grabbing a present, opening it, and finally gets down. There's just like a couple left. There's like this one big box and like my gift, which is obviously the shape of a ream of copy paper. And he grabs the big box and he reads the card, and it's this present from his mother. And he reads the card. It's very nice. And then he unwraps his present, and it's a typewriter. And so I'm like, Eureka, Johnny, open mine next. Open mine. And so he does, and he opens it, and it's a ream of copy paper. And I was like, Johnny, I knew you were going to need that, man. And then like I look over at his mom, and she's like, what? And so like I totally got away with it. And there's no real moral of the story other than like, I haven't changed. Like, I still like give people really crappy last-minute presents when I go to their birthday. So thank you.
Mike Baker, and just before him, Karen Walters. They were two of the Story Slam winners at the opening night of the Great New York State Fair Storytelling Festival on Friday, August 31st, 2018. I'm Bill Drake, and we're listening to highlights from the inaugural festival from this year's fair on tonight's Public Radio Presents. In addition to the opening night Story Slam, the second evening of the festival included two master storytellers. We heard from Linda Lowen earlier. Here's Sean Kirst with his story.
So I'm working in Buffalo now, as some of you might know, and the last few years I've not been able to come to the state fair the way I love the state fair, the way I'm used to the state fair. Last night we did this gig here where a bunch of people came in and told stories, and we listened and judged all of them. They were wonderful. But afterwards, I got to go outside, and I just had one of those wonderful moments where you're at the fair and you just go out there and you got no place to go. And I was just wandering around and I was smelling the smell and I heard the kids screaming on the rides, and I went over by the Gianelli's sausage stand, and I remembered holding my kids here, and I remembered that this place is like my backyard, and it was so overwhelming to be back here and to have this opportunity. So I'm grateful for all of you to be here. Genevieve called me about 6 months ago about this, about doing this gig, and asked me, do you have any stories from the state fair or any upstate New York stories? I've been covering the fair when I worked at the Post Standard since 1989. And I had to go back and had a bunch of different ideas, and we finally settled on one about a mechanical vampire on the Midway that some of you might remember in front of the Funhouse. And we worked on that for 3 or 4 weeks, and it was coming along. And 2 weeks ago, I go on to Facebook, and I see a Facebook item about something totally else, and it's a living, breathing, right now story that's attached to a story I wrote long ago, and I know I gotta write tell that story. So I go to Genevieve, meeting at Betts Library early on a Saturday morning. Can I switch up? And she's like, go ahead. So that's the story I'm going to tell today. It's alive, as all the great stories are. It continues, and it's happening. And I guess what I got to start out by saying is, some of you might remember, there used to be a dirt track here. There used to be a grandstand, and in front of that grandstand was a dirt track that was built, I believe, in 1899 for automobile races. There were harness races, too. But over the years, the greatest race car drivers in American history, A.J. Foyt, Mario Andretti, these guys raced on that track. People lived and died on that racetrack. There were deaths on that racetrack. It was one of the five largest dirt tracks, the Moody Mile, they called it, one of the five largest dirt tracks in the United States. But what it eventually became, the theme of Unravel this year, is New York state life, upstate life. And the amazing thing, it became eventually the home of Super Dirt Week in October, where tens of thousands of racing fans from all over the Northeast would come here. Used to be a 4th of July race, used to be a Labor Day race, and the kind of dirt racing that they did there, if you ever saw it, where these cars kind of looked like dune buggies with fans on the back, and they'd go hard into the corners and they'd kick up clouds of dirt. And throughout upstate New York, in towns like Hannibal, in towns like Owego, children grow up in these towns, and this is God's honest truth. They don't grow up wanting to be Derek Jeter. They grow up wanting to be Bob McCready. They grow up wanting to race on these dirt tracks, and the big dream for them for many, many years was to go to Syracuse, to go to Super Dirt Week in Syracuse and win the big race in October. So I wrote about that for years when I was... I started out in sports in the Post Standard, and it was this incredible scene, Super Dirt Week. Thousands of people would come in and camp and stay overnight and stay all week. And it was for dirt racing fans, it was like going to Daytona. So you know, life is life and things change. And a few years ago, the state decided they were going to get rid of the track. And that had some, you know, it had some sadness and some resonance for me, as it did for thousands of racing fans across the Northeast. And I decided I wanted to hit that ball hard. I wanted to write one last column about that racetrack that would capture what it was, you know? And so what happens is a guy named Chris Burgess, who I've never met, writes a letter to the Post Standard, and he's lamenting the atmosphere at the track and talking about what's going to be lost and what he's going to miss. And he says in this letter, I met a guy once who told me that he poured his father's ashes onto the track after he died. So I got to tell you, sometimes in what I do, there are just moments, there are things. I saw that and I thought, I got to find that guy. That story can't be lost. That story is a flash of light, and they're going to go in there, and they're going to level that track, and if I don't get that story, it's gone. And a story, losing a great story, is like losing a life. Once it's gone, it's gone. So I call Chris Burgess, photographer, never met the guy, and I tell him what I'm after, and he says, dude, I got bad news for you, man. I met the guy who told me that story in like 1994 at the Moody Mile, in the crowd. I have no idea who he was. I have no idea where he's from. All I know is that he would set up every year with his family on the third turn. So I'm a little morose. I'm thinking, I'm never going to get this guy. I'm never going to find him. But Chris Burgess says to me, says, don't forget what the Moody Mile is. Don't forget what Super Dirt Week is. These families come back year after year after year. They're liable to still be there if you go looking. So, you know, I want to find this story of the guy who poured his dad's ashes on the Moody Mile. But here's my problem. 3 years ago right now, that very week was the week, and you know what? I actually just choked up a little as I say this. 3 years ago that week, the very week that was the end of the Moody Mile, was the end of me at the Post Standard. It's the week I resigned. And I won't even get into what was going on because, you know, life is a confusing mountain range of rivers and peaks and valleys, right? But at that particular moment in my life, I felt very tired. I felt overwhelmed. I did not feel like I was telling the stories that I should be telling about this community the way I ought to be telling them. And one morning after working all night, I was sitting at a dining room table and I was tired, and I sent a note downtown that said, I gotta resign. Gave him a month's notice and said, I gotta resign. But the challenge with this was that my world had become midnight to midnight, coast to coast, and I felt like quantity was surpassing quality, and that the stories that I needed to be telling, I was having trouble getting at. And Clay, you know, exhibit one among them is the guy who dumps his father's ashes on the third turn at the Moody Mile, because here it was that week, track's going to be all gone, and I'm not getting there. I got no time to go out to the track and find this guy. So the race is Monday. I resign on Friday. Saturday morning, I got to be at the Syracuse airport, 4:30 a.m., because I'd committed months ago to one of the most important things I ever did, which was going with Honor Flight to Washington, D.C. These 90, 100-year-old World War II veterans. We get down to Washington, Bob Dole is waiting at the door to shake their hands as they go into the monument. I kid you not. There was a story there. I ran into a story on that honor flight that I almost ought to stop and tell you because it was so good. So I go to honor flight. I'm with these vets all day. I get back to Syracuse. I don't remember what time it was, but I go rolling into them, you know, come rolling home to my wife, who at that point, you know, knew me as a pair of shoes and a suit coat. I come rolling in, say hi to my wife, and I realize if I do not go to the Moody Mile that night, the race is Monday, it's Saturday night, if I don't go to the Moody Mile that night to try and find a guy I don't even know if he exists at the track that night, I'm never going to get the story about the ashes in the dust. So I drive out to the fairgrounds. I remember this. I get there at about 11:30, and this was the incredible cool thing about Super Dirt Week. They were just starting up. I mean, you know, you got to see the scene. You know, RVs and cars and tents, and it's just as far as you can see, and everybody burning campfires. And there were people, this was one of the coolest things I ever seen, they were setting up luminaries. Is that how you say it? Luminaries, whatever they are. Balloons with candles in them. Right? They're sending those up in the air above the fairgrounds. And I remember there's huge speakers and somebody's playing Don't Stop Believing, which I needed to hear. And so I go walking out to the track. So Syracuse, to kids who grow up wanting to be dirt racers, it's Fenway Park, right? It's Ebbets Field. It's where they want to drive. So this is the last race ever. And there are people who are just reverent. So I'm walking out there almost at midnight. The infield is the heart of it, where everybody stays. And I'm crossing that dirt track. And I remember there is men and women, just walking on that track and bending down and putting their fingers in it. Because it was sacred to them. It meant that much to them. These people came from hundreds, if not thousands of miles away for this race. If Syracuse didn't appreciate what it had, it was unbelievable. It was an incredible event. And I remember there were some little kids riding their bike on that dirt track, and it was just this amazing atmosphere. And I walk into the infield, and it's packed, and people partying, and people running around with lights on their hats, and you know, rock music and flags waving and the scent of charcoal, that football game smell. And so I start working. All I know is that this family was by the third turn. So I start working my way around, you know. Hey, excuse me. You don't know anybody who dumped their father's ashes on the track, do you? You know, it's midnight. People are half in the bag. They're like, I remember one group of guys play me along, you know, like I'm a big trout. They're kidding me. Other people are hostile. Most people are just, no, never heard that story. So it's getting out toward 12:30, pushing out toward 1 a.m. I come around the third turn. I'm about ready to give this up. And there is a thing that I cannot describe to you with what I do when something happens. I mean, if it works, if I'm at my best, if I'm cooking, I take that thing and it comes through me and goes to you. because I come around that turn and there's a bunch of people sitting around a campfire. And I walk up to this campfire, it's a little bit dark. Walk up to this campfire, I'm basically shot, I'm overtired, and I am grieving because I quit my job. And I already know I can't stop doing this. And I walk up to these people by this campfire, and I say to them, I gotta ask you, any of you guys ever hear a story about somebody dropping their father's ashes by that turn right there? And the guy in the middle, I think he was wearing a hoodie, big blue hoodie, looks up at me and says, that'd be my father. That'd be my father. His name is Fred Cousineau. I'd never met him before. Fred Cousineau, rock drummer, played with Dracula Jones, if some of you remember him. Up from the South Side, grew up on Newell Street. Newell Street, Nora, my wife's here, teaches at McKinley Brighton, taught at McKinley Brighton. That was where the school was. Grew up in that neighborhood. Told me his parents' first date was at the track. He said he was going to the Moody Mile when he was in his mother's womb. Grew up going out there all the time. One of his most powerful memories, his family would camp out there every year. Whole family would come. One of his most powerful memories was waking up early one morning, and he said, everything there was by the rhythm of the race, the sound of the engines. You set no alarm clock. You woke with the cars. You slept with the cars. And he remembers waking up one morning, and he looks out, and his dad is sitting by that campfire early in the morning, sun just coming up. And his father, who had worked so hard his entire life, is sitting there with a cup of coffee, and Fred had that incredible feeling when you know your father is happy. He just knew his dad was totally happy. So Ron Sr., Fred's father, heart disease. He dies in the early 90s. I think he was 42 years old. If Fred's here, he could tell me that for sure, but I think he was 42 years old. And he had asked his family to do one thing for him. And on the Memorial Day, after Ron Sr. dies, his family takes his ashes, drives out to the fairgrounds. If you remember the track, there were those days, the off-season days, there was no one around, just that big Moody Mile all by itself. And they went over on the third turn. The reason they set up by the third turn is they said that's where everything happens. It's not like a foot race where you have time on the last turn to make your move. In racing, if you're going to make a move, you do it on the third turn. So they could see it coming. That's why they set up there. They went to the place where things happened and things changed. That's why they were there. And on that day, this quiet Memorial Day, they went out there on the Moody Mile, and they got down, and they mixed his father's ashes with the dust. So, I went back, and I told that story. I wrote that story, and like I say, I think of anything, you know, it was a story I had to tell, and I got it online. I think I had it online before the race started Monday, ran in Tuesday's paper, and it sort of cemented a relationship between Fred and I, at least digitally. But also what it did for me was it just made me remember, you know, like, dude, what are you doing? You can't walk away from this. You got no choice. Because every story you don't tell is a candle going out. I mean, how could we not know that story? How could we not know that story? That when you go out on that midway, and you walk where the third turn used to be, you gotta know who's there. But this is the thing, stories never end. It's the river. We're all swept up. This isn't like baloney. I'm not up here doing a gimmick. You're all here for a reason. You're caught, you're brought here, as am I. We're just flashpoints bouncing off each other right now. We all got stories. 3 weeks ago, I'm on Facebook. And Fred Cousineau, drummer with a band called Pale Green Stars, I love that name, the Pale Green Stars, finds out that his band has been invited to play on the experience stage at the New York State Fairgrounds. But the fairgrounds is different now. It's not the fairgrounds as it was. It's not the fairground as we knew it. Midway has been changed. Direction's been changed. We got things we can do with the internet to compare maps and drop forms on top of each other. And something in Fred's gut tells him to look, and he finds out that the experience stage, where is it? It's on the third turn. August 23rd, 2018, Pale Green Stars take the stage on the site of the third turn. Fred's drumming. He said he didn't need to do anything special. He didn't need to do anything dramatic. Didn't need to kiss the ground. Didn't need. He saw a tree, he remembered. He saw a pond where they caught frogs when they were kids. He knew where he was. He knew what was beneath him. And he says to me, he says, I guess if you want to know, the only thing we did was that the very last song we played was a song called Don't Give Up. So I guess all I want to leave you with is that Fred came back to the New York State Fair, and so did I. Thanks.
Sean Kirst heard live on stage at the Great New York State Fair Storytelling Competition on Saturday, September 1st, 2018. We also heard from Linda Lowen from the same evening and from the three winners of the opening night Story Slam, Isaiah Buchanan, Karen Walters, and Mike Baker. Thanks for joining us for tonight's special. Genevieve Sponsler is the co-producer and director of the 2018 Great New York State Fair Storytelling Competition. Michelle Stanchel is co-producer. Our thanks to Dave Bullard and the Great New York State Fair, and to WRVO's Mark Lavonier. I'm Bill Drake. Thanks for listening.